Hi, we're Josh
and Arielle Wamsley,
owners of Green Valley Tree LLC, based in North Windham.
We're proud to sponsor Connecticut East this week and to serve the communities of Windham and New London counties with our tree removal and plant healthcare services.
Visit our website at greenvalleytreeworks.com for a full list of our services or give us a call on 860-234-4041. We look forward to hearing from you.
Connecticut Port Authority critic Kevin Blacker talks about his David and Goliath fight over the future of State Pier. And talking anti-black racism, UConn's new online course aimed at opening up the discussion about racism in the U.S. Plus a look at other stories making the headlines from around the region. This is Connecticut East This Week. Hello, I'm Brian Scott Smith. History is littered with battles between individuals and governments and large corporations when it comes to what is seen by those individuals as injustices or wrongdoing. Kevin Blacker is a resident of Noank and owns his own business, and since 2019, he's been a vocal critic of the Connecticut Port Authority and their plans to turn State Pier in New London into a hub for offshore wind and excluding other companies and businesses from using the pier. Blacker has attended meeting after meeting of the authority and has now been arrested for the second time by state police over his actions to draw attention to the State Pier deal. I caught up with him recently to talk about his most recent arrest and what his long-term plans are when it comes to his David and Goliath battle with the Connecticut Port Authority.
Kevin, as always, it's great to talk with you. We want to do a little bit of an update on your story. Continued, obviously, vocal critic of the Connecticut Port Authority, but a little while ago in the press, a report that you had been arrested for signs that you'd painted pink leading up to State Pier, which you freely admitted to. However, something happened with that story. We, the press, got involved in it. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I was charged with a felony for painting the signs. As you said, I admitted to it, offered and insisted that I take responsibility for it. The Port Authority submitted valuation of the signs for $1,663, which was $163 over the $1,500, limit that made it a felony. You know, that was all in the press. It was on NBC, TNH, Middletown Press. Maybe a week and a half ago, I had an interview with you, and luckily, you did some digging and pushing and found that the value of those signs was only $400, a fact that the state police or the Port Authority should have found, making the crime not a felony.
How did you feel about that? Because, it is the job of the press, obviously, to dig into and to look into things. And clearly it was very eye-opening to find out that the Department of Transport said, no, actually, these are our signs and we'll be replacing them, basically only $400. How does that make you feel? Because do you feel that the CPA is sort of retaliating against you because you just won't go away and you keep, jabbing them in the side about the State Pier deal?
Yes, I do. I do feel very clearly that the Connecticut Port Authority, as well as the Lamont administration, are retaliating against me, are infringing on my rights, and have violated my rights. I feel, as far as how I feel very proud of the American system, that the press did its job and kept the government honest. That's the role of the press. It's a central, they call it the fourth estate for a reason, and it's meant to keep the government honest. In this case, it protected me.
I'm going to put this question to you quite bluntly. I mean, they obviously consider that you are a troublemaker. Are you?
I thought about that question. That question took me off guard last time we spoke, and I would say now clearly, yes, I am a troublemaker, but as a friend from New Hampshire described it to me, it's good trouble. There's a difference between good trouble and bad trouble, and I am making trouble, but it's for a good purpose and it's for a good reason.
Fairly recently, you held an event in downtown New London. You had quite a good sort of turnout, and obviously it was to discuss this deal of State Pier. Tell us a little bit about it. Why did you organise it? And you know, tell us how it went.
The event, actually, a lady named Linda Blyce, who is just another citizen like me, she really was the one that organized it. And she got a permit from the City of New London to hold this event. She helped, you know, get the word around. And, you know, I helped her and was real supportive. And we wanted to get people together and talk about what was wrong with State Pier, talk about how to fix it. The event, I was really pleased. She was really pleased with how it went. There was about 25 people, 8 or 10 guys from the Longshoremen's Union, the ILA 1411. One of them drove down from Franklin, Mass. There was 8 or 10 guys from the salt business, Steve Farrelly, his wife, his son. You know, they were there. They talked about how negatively this deal is impacting them. The union and the truck drivers talked about, you know, how badly this is impacting them. There was, you know, 8 or 10 regular citizens who were there. So we had about an hour and a half discussion. Kat Goulart, who was running against Anthony Nolan, she was there and was extremely helpful in offering her perspective and advice on what to do. So I thought it was a really, really good meeting.
Apart from pricking the consciousness, obviously, of the press, who do continue to follow you and obviously report on matters. I mean, you know, we're doing an interview with you now because it is an important story. You've also pricked the consciousness of sort of local legislators as well. I mean, because, as you said, you've got people who were potentially running. You had, I believe, Anthony Nolan also did turn up as well. Does that buoy you in some way that, you know, that there is interest, not just obviously from the people who are affected, but representatives are showing an interest in this?
Let's see. I'd say that the interest from legislators in office has been shameful. Anthony Nolan was holding an event, you know, on an opposite, basically, street corner, stopped by, said hi, you know, right before or at the very beginning of the event, which I appreciated. It was very respectful. But elected officials taking stance or action on the issue of State Pier has been, you know, they haven't done enough. I would say they need to do more.
So despite, obviously, the two public sort of information hearings that were held, what you're saying is you've not been approached or you've not really heard anything from legislators, despite what we all saw is a lot of questions being asked by, you know, by these representatives, but nothing seems to be happening, is what you're saying.
I'd say that those things were more of a political show, that the informational hearings were informational hearings. They weren't hearings. They were informational forums. A public hearing would have allowed, you know, for off-script questioning. They would have allowed for people like me to ask questions. But basically, the forums that they held were very scripted and controlled.
Now, the Connecticut Port Authority has a new executive director. He was formerly in Maine. He did a very similar job in Maine, but now obviously takes the reins here in Connecticut. What are your hopes for him?
So I have a pretty good amount of hope for him because, you know, I've read about him. I see that he has had a successful career, a good reputation, and he's going to be faced with a choice of whether he wants to bet his reputation on a scandal-ridden, dishonest organization trying to push an illogical deal through on his name. And I'm excited that, you know, in that situation, I know anybody that cared about their name would think really hard about, you know, his name will be on this deal. So I think there's a good possibility that he's going to get in, you know, see the dishonesty and corruption, see the bad judgment, and refuse, you know, to put his name on it, to gamble his name on something that doesn't make sense.
Talking of reputation and name, obviously you do have a reputation, certainly with the Connecticut Port Authority and the administration. What does that mean to you? Because obviously your name is very much out there, as you said earlier in this conversation, when you were arrested and initially it was a felony charge that was brought against you. Of course, that was all in the public domain. What does that do to you as a person who's trying to fight this fight?
I think reputation and name are very, you know, name and word are very, very important. I've said before that I feel strongly enough about some things that I'll risk my reputation. This is one of them. And I have enough patience and faith to know that in the short term, people may think badly of me, but in the long term, it's going to, without doubt, I know that I'm going to come out on the right side, and that, you know, people will understand in time, you know, what I'm doing and why I'm doing the things that I'm doing.
In the past, you've done this very much by yourself. I mean, are you thinking now that as this continues, because this clearly is going to be a long drawn out fight between you and the state and the Connecticut Port Authority, will you consider possibly getting legal representation and maybe taking it in that direction, or at least covering yourself? Because they're not backing down either.
Let's see, I will consider getting legal representation, but it wouldn't be to cover myself. It would be to attack them. Neither of us are going to back down, but I'm going to win. That's how the fight's going to end. And so I'm going to consider everything. I'm going to consider all my options. I'm going to beat them.
And any sort of final thoughts as you move forward? Because I said you had a very successful meeting, you know, recently with people who clearly have an interest in this, are interested in this. Is there sort of a bit of a strategy for the next 6 months or anything going forward as to what you feel you need to do to keep this going?
What I feel that I need to do is I need to get any honest legislator in the state and any member, any curious member of the press to hear what I heard from the longshoremen, from the salt company, from the fishermen, from the people negatively affected. I need the legislators and the press to hear that, which requires the legislators and the press to ask, but it also requires those people to have enough trust and faith in the legislators and the press to share what they've been sharing with me, you know, for a year. And once that happens, and once there's enough attention on what's going on, the problems, you know, won't continue.
Kevin Blacker, as always, it's good to talk to you, and obviously we'll continue to follow this story.
Thank you very much, Brian.
Before our interview with Kevin Blacker, we reached out to the Connecticut Port Authority over their $1,600 valuation for the signs Blacker damaged. After a Connecticut East This Week investigation with the Department of Transport found the cost to replace them was in fact $400. The authority informed us in a statement they had utilized the services of a state-approved contractor to ascertain the cost to replace the damaged signs, and they had no say in what the state police would charge Kevin Blacker with. They did confirm that upon receiving our new information about the real cost to replace the signs, they passed this on to the state police, and in turn, the state police have completed a supplemental report on Blacker's case, which means he will hopefully not be charged with a felony offence now when he appears in court in October. Although we aren't seeing it on TV news or reading about it as much in our newspapers and online news feeds, protests are still ongoing in the country over Black Lives Matter and public outrage over police brutality and racism in the country. I spoke with Dr. Sade Davis, Assistant Professor of the Department of Communication at UConn in Storrs, about their new online course for students that she and her colleagues created that discusses these issues. Dr. Davis, thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Now, UConn is offering a anti-Black racism course. Can you tell us how that came about and what will it cover?
So the course came about in July, actually. There was a town hall hosted by the African American Cultural Center. and the president was present and involved. And the students had, you know, communicated to President Katsalaeus that the university had put together a one-unit course to address COVID as, you know, a pandemic that, of course, took the globe by storm. And so had communicated that we're in the midst of another pandemic, and that's anti-Black racism, and wanted to know what the president was going to do about that, and how the university was going to pivot in terms of responding. And so the president said, you know, I'm committed to doing that and to putting together a course for us to be able to talk about this issue as well. So that was in July. Talked with the provost and Provost Carl Lejeune, and the provost asked myself and my two co-conspirators, as I call them, Dr. David Embrick and Dr. Milagros Castillo Montoya. And we've just been working around the clock for 7 weeks with so many community partners to make it happen. And the course is a 9-module course, but 7 content modules covering topics from legacies of chattel slavery, Black health and wellness, to intersectional solidarity.
Interesting question for you. UConn is an amazing university, you know, leading in many areas. Why was this type of course not available before, do you think?
Well, that's actually a really great question. There are other, you know, 3-unit courses available from, you know, Black feminist politics that's taught by my colleague, Dr. Evelyn Simeon. You know, my own course, People of Color and Interpersonal Communication, not specific to Blackness specifically, but certainly touches upon that in the research. So don't get me wrong, there are courses, but this course is unique in that, you know, A, it's university-wide. The other courses are specific to certain departments on campus. And B, it really is not just about the curriculum and the information, but it's also a symbolic gesture, right? That the president was responsive to needs of the Black students on campus. And so this is really just an entry point for us to be able to have a conversation of how are we going to be addressing anti-Black racism in UConn's undergraduate and graduate, but curriculum, and making certain courses mandatory, thinking about our general education requirements. So it's really just an entry point for a larger conversation.
Now, you mentioned that you called them your two other co-conspirators, but this course is made up of many more contributors as well, other eminent people in their field. Tell us more about that.
This course has actually been such a beautiful demonstration of just collaboration and campus partnerships. We have some amazing Black faculty across UConn schools, actually, who contributed to the making of this course, including our Black faculty in CLAS, including the director, Dr. Wisdom Powell of the Health Disparities Institute. We have faculty from Allied Health. We have a faculty person from UConn's Law School. So it's just really great to be able to highlight them. Our advisory board is made up of our new CDO, Dr. Frank Tewitt, the director of the African American Cultural Center and the director of Africana Studies Institute. We have CEDL, which has been just instrumental in the actual development of this course because it is an asynchronous course online, and helping us, you know, getting that developed. Various resources, offices, centers, institutes on campus where we wanted to be sure to highlight them and how they play a pivotal role in UConn as one community combating anti-Black racism. And the list goes on. Our Black students, we wanted to be sure that their voices were included in the development of this course as well. So yes, so many individuals. And then of course, the provost, right, who and the president who were sure that this course was going to happen and that we had all the resources we need to get it done.
Let me put this question to you as a Black woman yourself and seeing, you know, what is going on in this country, continue to be going on in this country for many years. Are you somewhat disheartened that Black history, it's taken this long until now for it to really start to become what it should have always been, which is there in the public consciousness and in the public education system?
Absolutely. Disheartened to even put it lightly. I feel stripped, or not, I shouldn't say stripped, but I feel as though I wasn't given all the resources, all the tools that I need, because as a human being, I deserve to know where I come from. I deserve to know my history. I deserve to know more about my ancestors in the same way that other people from other racial groups, other nationalities get to learn about their ancestors. And so I think that this country has done Black folks an incredible disservice. And again, to put that lightly, that we have not learned more about our history. And to be clear, Black history is American history, right? They go hand in hand.
The other point I wanted to put to you, Doctor, is what do you hope, other than the obvious, you know, a solid education and a much better understanding of Black history, what else do you want students to get from this course?
I want them to really just to think about what this means, what anti-Black racism means for them and their kind of racial identity, and also for them to be able to note how, again, various entities on campus are, I guess, related or connected to this issue. I think because UConn is so big and is so expansive, some students don't even realize all of the different arms and tentacles and entities, you know, that are available to them. And so we're also hoping that this can be kind of collate, again, those different resources on campus. Again, we can only do so much in terms of introducing students to research and to the topic. And that's why we, of course, we have the 3-unit classes, right? So students can delve into those topics with the experts. And so this is really just a tasting platter, right? And so we hope to really whet students' appetite and to then, you know, get them connected to other courses where they can learn so much more.
Another thing that I was reading in the release about this incredible story in this course is also that you hope it offers options for students to learn more about mental and physical health, and also the disparities in public health, which are all too obvious and all too abhorrent, actually, in the American health system when it comes to the Black and brown community.
Yes. Absolutely. That was a necessary and I think obvious topic that had to be included in this class. And is a really great, I guess, a dovetail, right? A supplement even to the 1-unit COVID course that UConn put together and was offered in spring.
This, as I say, it's an incredible online course, which is important not only for students to take. Wouldn't this also benefit a wider non-student audience as well, like the rest of us?
Absolutely. And in fact, this class is free. So it's free to our students. We're opening it up to graduate students who, of course, are students, but of course, in a very different position in their kind of professional trajectory. But it's also open to faculty and staff, right? We can't assume that just because an individual has a PhD, that they know the basics when it comes to racism and specifically in anti-Blackness. And that there are so many staff at UConn as well who would like to learn more. And again, this might be an entryway, right? A gateway of sorts for them to be able to kind of get their feet wet. And again, we're here to wet people's palates. Again, it's a 1-unit course, right? So we're so limited in what we're able to cover and how deep we can go. Actually, we can't go deep. So we just hope to pique people's interest and to reach, cast a wider net to reach more people.
My final question to you, Doctor, and so many thanks for your time today. Again, with everything that's going on in the world, with courses like this, do you feel that the country is, and we hear this phrase all the time, a turning point, do you genuinely think this country is at a turning point where they will start to acknowledge, understand, and move away from the racism that has pervaded this country for so long?
I think we have a window of opportunity. I do, to, as I say, you know, strike while the iron is hot, and for us to be swift and to kind of get into action and to make lasting changes, right? While this window is open. So I'll say that I'm hopeful in that regard, in that I recognize we're the moment that we're in. I will say it won't be open forever. And those who have been awakened, I'm pretty sure many of them will go back to sleep. Many of them will turn the channel. So I think that yeah, it's important for us to just seize the moment and to galvanize, to get all the necessary resources we need, again, to make swift and long-lasting structural change.
Dr. Sade Davis, Assistant Professor, Department of Communication at UConn. We also hope that it opens people's eyes and that their eyes do actually stay open for a lot longer and we see the change in this country that is so desperately needed. Thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Green Valley Tree LLC is proud to sponsor Connecticut East This Week. Contact Green Valley Tree LLC for all your tree removal and plant health care needs and more. Find us at greenvalleytreeworks.com or call 860-234-4041.
Time now for a look at some of the other stories making the headlines in the region recently. In the Connecticut Examiner, Governor Lamont and Mystic Aquarium President and CEO Dr. Stephen Cohen announced a $31.5 million public-private partnership that will eliminate the aquarium's debt and allow it to continue functioning through the pandemic. The package includes $10 million raised in private donations, $14.5 million in debt elimination, and a $7 million long-term loan from the state for working capital. At a press conference at the aquarium, Cohen said the partnership will enable the aquarium not only to survive, but to thrive. In the day this week, vacant for 37 years, what's known locally as the Waterford Airport property at 140 Waterford Parkway South is once again a target for development, this time by Fabcom Precast, a concrete manufacturer based in Minnesota. At 188 acres, the airport property value is currently about $4.3 million, according to the town's tax assessor's office. Since it opened its first plant in 1971, Fabcom has steadily expanded its operations. The company now has plants in Minnesota, Ohio, Kansas, and Pennsylvania. In the Norwich Bulletin, a vote to increase the property tax break for Norwich volunteer firefighters passed unanimously with the public support of Alderwoman Stacey Gould, a volunteer firefighter with the East Great Plain Volunteer Fire Department. The updated ordinance takes advantage of a measure enacted in the state legislature last year that allows cities and towns to increase the property tax abatement already available to volunteers. The measure was meant to bolster recruitment efforts amid declining volunteer levels at fire departments statewide. The abatement, which has been set at $1,000, will rise to $1,500 in the coming fiscal year and $2,000 the following year. In the Middletown Press this week, Durham, Middlefield and Middletown are joining with Cromwell to ensure that as many people as possible get an influenza vaccine as the flu season draws near. The four towns are sponsoring a total of 10 flu clinics beginning now and continuing through November 10th. In addition to the flu vaccine, pneumonia and shingles vaccines will also be available during the free-of-charge clinics. The clinics are being held on a first-come, first-served basis, meaning appointments will not be taken. Residents will receive a quadrivalent inoculation, which is intended to prevent them from getting up to four strains of the flu. In the Chronicle, federal officials have fined and cited a local psychiatric hospital for not properly providing necessary pandemic protection protocols during the coronavirus crisis. The Occupational Health and Safety Administration issued Natchog Hospital citations and $13,494 in fines after determining the hospital failed to provide adequate protection to its employees through the pandemic. Natchog, which is at 189 Stores Road in Mansfield, is part of Hartford HealthCare's Behavioral Health Network. And to honor and commemorate the life and accomplishments of U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the Lyman Allen Art Museum in New London has just installed a large-scale portrait of Ginsburg by local artist Jack LaHave, which will be on view through October 18th this year. Admission to the museum is free to all through the end of September. Justice Ginsburg served on the U.S. Supreme Court from 1993 until her recent death on September 18th due to complications from metastatic pancreatic cancer. Ginsburg worked as an advocate for gender equality and women's rights over the course of her long and remarkable career. That's all from us for this edition. Do send us your questions and story ideas to the show via our website at connecticut-east.com or Facebook or Twitter at Connecticut East, where you can also listen to the show again on demand. And please like, follow and share on your social media platforms too. I'm Brian Scott Smith. Thank you for listening.